Welcome back to the second hour, Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers, Harriet Williamson and Martha Deal. Jason Croft is at the controls this morning. We're also pleased to welcome back here to the program the man we call our family doctor. His name is Jeff Swearingen. He's a family practice physician at Carl Clinic in Urbana. And every other month on a Monday, he is here, and we do the show that we call Talk to the Family Doctor. Occasionally throughout the year, we have people who deal in specialty areas, but he is a generalist, and the idea is whatever kind of healthcare question you have, please do call in and ask questions. We always want to say we can't diagnose over the phone. There are limitations as to what we can do because the doctor can't see you, but this is a kind of place that you could start. Ask some basic questions, get some basic kind of information, and then you may need to go on and pursue the problem with your own physician or someone who can see you. But this is a good place to start, and you can ask questions. And because he deals with people of all ages in his practice, if your question is for yourself, for someone in your family, could be for grown-ups, could be for kids, any and all of that is fine, and I know he would do his best to help you out. So, with that, I'll give you the telephone number. It's 333-9455. That's for Champaign-Urbana. We do also have a toll-free line. That's good anywhere that you can hear us. So, if it would be a long-distance call, use that number. That's 800-222-9455. And at any point here, you give us a call, we'll try to take as many calls as we can. Thank you for being here once again.
Thank you, David. Glad to be back.
We have someone here ready to go, so we'll get right to them. A caller in Urbana and on line one. Hello.
Hi. I've been seeing information about getting a shingles shot if you are 60 or over, and including full-page ads in the newspaper from the company that's producing them. But I'm wondering whether – I haven't heard that they're available locally. Do you know anything about actually getting the shots?
The shot is available locally. The problem basically centers around whether enough has been ordered to fulfill the desires of everybody who wants to get one, and whether the manufacturer can then ship enough orders to get here. So we actually have been giving them at the clinic, but we periodically run out. It takes us a week or two to get another shipment in. So for individuals who are interested in it, if it's not temporarily available, you can simply have your name put on a waiting list and the office can contact you when the next shipment gets in. The vaccination is indeed intended for individuals over the age of 60 who do have a prior history of chickenpox, and the vaccination is intended to reduce the likelihood that they will develop shingles, which is essentially a reactivation of the chickenpox virus in the body. It generally produces a very painful type of rash. The major problem is that for some folks, after the rash goes away, much like chickenpox rash goes away, even after the rash goes away, some people continue to have pain in the nerve where the virus was reactivated. And that can be, for some folks, actually quite debilitating. I had an elderly lady in the hospital just a few weeks ago because of exactly this kind of problem. And so anything that sort of can be done to help prevent that is probably a reasonable thing to do.
Does one need to have the approval of your primary care doctor, or can you walk in to, is there an immunization clinic? Is this part of the flu clinic?
No. Actually, the only immunizations that are routinely given with what's sort of a standing order for the general public are flu shots for influenza and pneumonia vaccinations. You would need an order from your primary physician for the shingles vaccination.
I also understand that when you have the first signs of shingles, if you recognize them, that there is a different kind of shot. Is it something like Novocaine? I can't remember. That can help short circuit the attack. Maybe you could talk about that as well, what to look for, what to recognize, and then what to do if you have an attack of shingles.
Actually, in most instances, people will have a feeling in the skin. It's often a tingling, burning kind of sensation, very similar to the feeling that people get just before their cold sores break out. Many people can tell sort of when they're going to get one. Chickenpox and shingles virus are in the herpes family. This is referred to as herpes zoster. And the individuals who have either oral or genital herpes lesions will often say that they can feel a tingling or burning sensation in the skin before any visible lesion appears. This is often confusing because people will come in and say, you know, I have pain in a particular area, and you look and you don't see anything, and it's not until a day or two later that they start to get what look like little blisters, like they're coming down with chickenpox. But it's basically in just a band distribution. It will just be a very narrow strip of skin that's affected. The chest wall is the most common place that it occurs, and it'll be a little band of what looks like chickenpox, but it's very, very uncomfortable. So unfortunately, it's very hard to make the diagnosis at the very earliest stage because you can't see the rash. But if indeed the rash has just started, there really isn't an injection to make it go away, but we will frequently put people on antiviral medications that are used to treat herpes viruses, and we will oftentimes use some prednisone, which is a cortisone-type medication, to help decrease inflammation and reduce some of the discomfort. The antiviral medications can indeed shorten the length of time that the virus is active and can reduce the severity of the illness.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Right,
thanks. Just now to review on this vaccine for shingles, is now the general recommendation that anyone over 60 who has had chickenpox, mm-hmm. and that's going to be a lot of people for all of us oldsters who were
right.
who were born before there was the vaccine for chickenpox, it is now the recommendation that all of us should have the vaccine for shingles?
It currently falls into the it's available, and if you're concerned, yes, you can get it. It has not, to my knowledge, become a standard, yes, everybody should get it type of recommendation.
Mm-hmm. And, well, everybody, almost every, well, again, at a certain point, almost everybody got chickenpox. Everybody doesn't get shingles.
That's correct.
How many people actually do end up getting shingles?
Well, since there are literally tens of millions of people who had chickenpox, even if it's just a small percentage of the population, you're still talking about, you know, hundreds of thousands of people every year who come down with shingles. And the degree of severity of the shingles attack can vary from, oh, gee, I had a couple little spots and it was sore for a few days, to, as I said, we had an elderly lady in the hospital recently who was just absolutely miserable and required IV narcotic pain medication. So, and there are a few unfortunate souls who get what's referred to as post-herpetic neuralgia, that persistent burning pain in the distribution of the nerve even after the rash goes away. And that can go on for weeks to months. So for those folks, preventing their shingles turns out to be really worthwhile. Unfortunately, there isn't any way of predicting who of all the people who had chickenpox are going to come down with shingles, and of those who have shingles, who's going to have the really, really bad case. Mm-hmm. So it falls into a category of, you know, if you're concerned about it and you fall into the over 60 had chickenpox and you want to do something to reduce your risk of shingles, then this is a very reasonable thing to do.
If one has had an outbreak of shingles, if you had it once,
it's very, very unusual to ever see somebody get it again.
So there's no. So if you've had it, there would be no reason for then going and getting the vaccine,
no.
or maybe it wouldn't do anything,
right?
And it wouldn't have any effect. So it's right. So it's only as a preventative,
correct?
No, a prevent. That's one too many T's, I think. Anyway, to try to keep you from getting it in the first place.
Right.
If you've had it, then
and we still don't understand exactly what causes the virus to reactivate. When you've had chickenpox and the rash goes away, and you say, "Gee, I just got over the chickenpox," your body actually retains the virus. It continues to live in the nerve roots in the in the spine. In the vast majority of people, it just sits there and doesn't do anything because most people don't get shingles. But somewhere along the line, certain individuals get that virus reactivated and it goes out from the spine along one of the nerve roots and basically produces this painful burning rash again. In some instances, it's thought that some change in the body's immune system allows the virus to reactivate. And consequently, people who are immunosuppressed, people who have been on cancer chemotherapy, AIDS patients, may indeed be more likely to develop shingles. At times of great either physical stress, if you're having a major illness and your immune system's perhaps busy doing something else, if you've had some sort of major trauma, physical trauma, again, there seem to be little triggering events that seem to reactivate the virus. But there are other times when there seemingly isn't any really good explanation at all, other than it tends to be more common as people get older, and that's thought to be just due to the sort of waning of the immune system with age.
Mm. All right. We have some other callers here. Next, let's talk with someone in Rantoul on our line two. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Thank you for taking my call. My question pertains to the shingles also, and you've answered one question about whether you should have a shot if you've already had. I have. But I had do have one more question. I don't know what else to call it, except it's like a leftover from the shingles, like a little scar or something, several of those. And occasionally they will either hurt like the dickens or itch like crazy. And I will hang up and listen, but I would like to know if there's something I can put on there or something I can take. Okay, I will hang up, and thank you.
All right.
This may actually be just a very, very mild case of post-herpetic neuralgia, where the active blister-like chickenpox-looking lesions have gone away. The scars themselves can indeed remain, but generally speaking, for most individuals, once their shingles is over, the rash has gone away, it doesn't hurt anymore. So if there's continued pain or irritation, there's something still irritating the nerve. In many instances, it can be simply treated symptomatically. You can take your Tylenol, you can take your Advil. If it's severe, as I said, people have required narcotic medications to control that. If it's truly persistent, then in many instances, what people would refer to as a nerve medicine, and I don't mean from the anxiety standpoint, but more from the standpoint of seizure-type medications are often used. Medications like Tegretol, Neurontin, these are medications that in the past were typically used to control seizures, but are also used for irritation to nerve fibers at other locations. Many diabetic patients develop painful peripheral neuropathies where the diabetes has damaged the nerve and they hurt. And these types of medications have been used in situations like that, but is also used for post-herpetic neuralgia.
Okay. Well, I hope that helps, Gar. Let's talk next with someone on a cell phone, line one. Hello.
Yes, hello. Good morning.
Mm-hmm.
In reference to the information about the shingles, I had contacted the clinic about a month ago about the immunization, and at that time I was told that the injection would cost $400 and that health insurance or the provider I have does not pay for it. I know that you don't have much to do with billing, but my question was, beside the cost, is only one injection required, or is it a multi-series of injections?
You're correct. I don't have a lot to do with the billing, so I'm sorry I don't know much about that. But no, this is a single injection, just given the one time. In many instances, health insurance companies in general don't cover services that are considered to be elective. If this vaccination turns out to be as effective as I'm sure the drug company hopes it turns out to be, there may indeed at some point in the future be a standard recommendation that, you know, everybody in the appropriate category get this immunization. At the point where something becomes a standard recommendation, most health insurance companies then adopt those recommendations and then will cover the use of it.
I'm sorry?
Most of the time, once it has become a standard recommendation, most insurance companies will then start to pay for anything that is considered to be a standard recommended treatment or, in this case, preventive measure.
All right. So at the present time, then, it's not considered to be on that list yet.
That's going to vary by insurance company as to what they do or don't include. But no, I'm not currently aware of any national medical societies that basically state that this should be an automatic for everybody.
Okay. Well, thank you for your information.
All right. Thanks for the call. Our guest this morning is Dr. Jeff Swearingen. He's a family practice doctor at Carl Clinic in Urbana. Every other month he is here on the program. It's always on a Monday. For the show, we call Talk to the Family Doctor. If you have questions, I know he will do his best to help you out. 333-9455 here in Champaign, Urbana. Toll free, 800-222-9455. Next caller is in Watsika, line 4. Hello.
Thank you for taking my call. Mm-hmm. My question is about E. coli bacteria in food. As I understand E. coli, it can be killed with cooking.
Correct.
Okay. The E. coli, which is on California vegetables, is this on the surface or is this in the plant tissue? And can this be eliminated through proper washing, or is cooking necessary to eliminate the bacteria?
Generally speaking, the bacterial contamination is external, and indeed proper washing and or cooking should indeed be able to eliminate it.
Okay, wonderful. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. And let's go next to Champaign. This is line number 2.
Yes,
hello.
Good morning.
Mm-hmm.
I have two questions. I did tune in late, so I'm not quite sure if you've answered my question about shingles. What do shingles look like on the skin?
A lot like chickenpox, except that it will generally be in a strip or band, usually going around the trunk.
Around the trunk, not on the extremities.
You can have it on the extremities, face, head, and neck. It's just not nearly as common there. But it will generally be in a long band or strip. If you mark, you know, where the lesions are and kind of draw a border around it, you will find that if you look that up with the nerve distribution charts that you can sometimes see in an anatomy book, you'll find that the rash basically follows what we call a dermatome, or where the nerve runs underneath the skin.
Okay, thank you. I have a question about subcutaneous things that develop under the skin. I have, over the years, had these bumps that seem to come on hands and elbows mostly, and they can be very painful because, you know, if you put your hand down wrong, you're pressing on something, and then they go away. And I wonder if this is an unusual occurrence. Is this something I should mention when I get a physical?
I'm a little puzzled. Hands and elbows are not common locations for skin or subcutaneous abnormalities. Probably the most helpful thing I can probably suggest is to simply have your physician take a look at it when you have one.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not aware of any type of at least serious illness associated with what you just described in the absence of, you know, other symptoms at the time. So it, if in fact it's coming and going, it's probably not something terribly worrisome. But as I said, that's not a common location for skin or subcutaneous problems. So without...
Well, it's been my elbow and around the knuckles of my hand.
I'm sorry, not a whole lot is coming to mind here in terms of...
Does this happen at any particular time of year?
No. It'll hang on for a year or two and then gradually subside. And, you know, I just never paid a whole lot of attention to it. But I was hearing the discussion about shingles, and I thought, oh, what a strange little happening I have here.
No, that would certainly be unrelated to our shingles discussion. Mm-hmm. As to sort of what that is, I think this is one of those where radio is going to fail us. So I think that's something that you'd actually have to have somebody take a look at.
Okay. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Thanks for the call. I kind of think that's the problem with skin, particularly with we've had dermatologists on the show.
That's a tough one to do over the radio.
I have this rash. Can you tell me what that is? And they say, no, not without seeing you. All right. Well, in any case, we're about our midpoint here. We have another caller. We would certainly take as many as we can. Again, our guest, Dr. Jeff Swearingen from Carle Clinic, is the guest. He's a family practice doctor. So we take kind of general questions. We cover a lot of things. And again, with the limitation that we can't see you, if you have a question, CERN, you'd like to talk about, you give us a call. 333-9455. Toll-free, 800-222-9455. And we have another champagne caller next, line 3. Hello.
Hi.
Yeah.
Hi. I wear a mouth guard, so I'm a grinder, unfortunately. In terms of the right ear and stuff, it's, you know, similar when you take a shower, you know, when you get water in there and such. But without the shower, it seems like it used to build up a little bit, but I'm getting a little bit more of a buildup than usual. Is there anything that can be a cold or can be other things, or what is that?
The most common reason for people to complain of little, you know, pressure building up in their ears is usually just earwax. And in many instances, a over-the-counter earwax softening drop used for a few days along with a little warm water irrigation will usually clear that out. Otherwise, if the ear canal is clear, you basically need to be able to see the ear drum in order to comment on whether there's something else going on in the ear.
Yeah, because it seems to be, I've always had maybe a little fluid, but it's more of a fluid, and, you know, I can sort of get it out. But on the other hand, I'm just wondering if something else, it seems to me it might be worth taking a look at, because I don't think I remember having this much, but I thought maybe the grinding might... But it's not, it doesn't occur in the left ear, so that's...
Generally, the teeth grinding produces, you know, what is commonly referred to as temporomandibular joint syndrome, or TMJ, and that usually is associated with some discomfort that people often localize to the ear simply because your jaw joint sits right in front of your ear, and when one of them hurts, it kind of feels like the other one hurts. But generally speaking, it's not associated with any type of drainage or any kind of material from the ear that would be due to TMJ.
Okay. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, again, other questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. I thought, too, we should probably remind people once again that if you have not gotten a flu shot and you want to, you still can, and it's not too late to do that. Probably a good idea.
That is exactly right. Certainly, all of those folks in the recommended categories, which are definitely individuals over the age of 65, currently children from 6 months to 5 years are also in the recommended category, primarily because they tend to be the sort of reservoir for the virus. Mm-hmm. They may get the flu, but they bounce back pretty quickly. The problem is that they'll then give it to the adults who don't bounce back quite as well. So children from 6 months to 5 years of age are definitely recommended. all pregnant women, regardless of where they are in their pregnancy. It used to be just after the first trimester, but it's basically now all pregnant women, regardless of their gestational age, should be immunized. And individuals under the age of 65 who have chronic medical illnesses where, if you threw the flu on top of that, could really be a problem, such as any type of chronic lung disease, bad heart disease, or diabetes, are also recommended to be immunized. Mm. Individuals, in addition to the flu shot, those folks over age 65 should also be getting a pneumonia vaccination.
Okay. Let's talk a little bit about pneumonia. I know we've talked about this before, and I'm still not quite sure that I understand. I'm a little mystified by exactly what it is, how you get it, where it comes from. And it seems to be one of those things where if you're already sick, it opens the door for this to come along and make mm-hmm. you even more sick.
Mm-hmm.
And that once you have had it once, that increases your susceptibility to have it again. Is that
not
true?
Necessarily. It's often those individuals who got it in the first place who genuinely are susceptible to illness, period. So we're often dealing with elderly patients whose immune systems due to age are decreased, individuals who have, again, any type of immunosuppression, whether it's HIV, cancer treatment, chronic steroid use. There are a number of categories where somebody's going to be just more susceptible to infection. And any type of multiple chronic diseases, again, heart disease, lung disease, diabetes, all of these things are going to make people a little bit more susceptible because their immune system is just not in good a shape. The pneumonia strictly just means an infection in the lung. And you can have a viral pneumonia. There's unfortunately not a whole lot you can do about that other than let it run its course. You can have bacterial pneumonias, and these are the ones that we treat with antibiotics. The pneumonia vaccination does not protect against viral pneumonia and does not even protect against all bacterial pneumonias. It does protect against a certain subset of pneumonias that in the past have been the ones that were most likely to be fatal. So, people sometimes are a little upset. They said, well, I had a pneumonia vaccination.
And I got pneumonia.
How come I have pneumonia? And the answer is the vaccination does not protect against all types, but it does usually protect against the worst types.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So just like with the flu shot, you can get a flu shot and that's you could still get the flu.
Basically, with immunizations, you're simply trying to shift the odds more in your favor. And in many instances, you can shift them way in your favor. But there are very few things in life that are 100%.
Yeah. So it sounds like the thing is that the bacteria and the viruses that can cause pneumonia, they're out there in the environment. They're always there. And that if you are already sick, maybe your immune system is working really hard to fight that off and it's not at 100%, or there's something else that would mean that your immune system would not be at 100%, that, and you encounter the bacteria and the virus. A healthy person might kind of shake it off, but if somebody's not healthy, then it's going to swing.
In many instances, a healthy person can be exposed to the illness but not become ill because their body does the right thing. It intercepts it and takes care of it and makes it go away. Or some variation in between there. They may have a very minor illness as opposed to somebody at the other end of the spectrum who has a very major, potentially life-threatening illness.
Mm-hmm. So if one, if you were, say somebody was already sick, say you had a very bad cold, maybe you had bronchitis, you had something like that, what would be your sign that perhaps also now you were talking about pneumonia? What would be the things to look for?
In most instances, people who have what we would consider sort of an upper respiratory illness, a cold or a bronchitis, if they develop an active lung tissue infection, something that's deep down inside the respiratory tract, a lower respiratory infection as such, a pneumonia would be, they're generally going to feel more ill. Mm-hmm. And a fair number of the physical findings would be a rise in temperature. Often corresponds with the bacteria getting more actively involved in your entire system. If it becomes a bloodborne infection, the bacteria can go anywhere, actually. But the lung is a common place for it to end up. But people are going to feel sicker. They're going to have higher temperatures. They're going to cough up perhaps nastier-looking stuff. And they're going to have more respiratory symptoms. They're going to feel more short of breath and oftentimes will have some localizing discomfort on the right or the left, depending on where the pneumonia is. There will be physical findings that are often apparent on examination. And then chest x-rays can be used if there's any question about what's going on as well.
So if you have that kind of collection of symptoms, you should get it checked out.
Yes, very much.
Yeah, all right, let's talk with another caller here. Line one, Champagne. Hello.
Hi, I'm a middle-aged male, heretofore pretty active. I'm having what's been diagnosed as discomfort in my knees due to thinning cartilage, and even the suggestion that total knee replacement will be in my future. I'm trying to forestall that and or stay as active as I can. Friends tout the benefits of the glucosamine chondroitin type stuff, and I've had some limited relief from using a thing called Devil's Claw. Does any of these things actually rebuild cartilage, and are there any, whether that's the case or not, are there any other good things to try?
I'm not familiar with that last product you mentioned, so I really can't comment on that. The glucosamine has indeed been recommended, and it is not something that seems to work for everybody, which there isn't a good explanation for. But the current theory is that, yes, it is part of helping you rebuild cartilage. I generally tell people that the glucosamine is safe, so there's really not much downside to giving it a try, but it's not in and of itself an anti-inflammatory agent. It's not a pain medication. It's something that you're taking for 4 to 6 months as a trial to see if indeed it seems to be helpful in terms of how your weight-bearing joints feel to you. The problem that you describe for yourself is a very common one. Guys who like to stay very physically active, frequently run or play basketball or racket, something where they're exerting quite a bit of stress on the weight-bearing joints, and the cartilage for some individuals just starts to wear down, and that can become uncomfortable. There aren't too many 70-year-old marathon runners for a reason, and it's not because their hearts give out. It's because their knees and hips and ankles start to wear out, and it just becomes uncomfortable. And this is where we typically encourage people to do some sort of cross training. You shouldn't run 7 days a week. You should get on a bicycle. You should try an elliptical. You should take up swimming. Try and get the weight off your knees, but still maintain some cardiovascular fitness. And in most instances, temporary measures, cortisone injections, there are some artificial fluid injections that can be placed in knees where everything's wearing out. But long term, if somebody has pain that they can't otherwise live with, then the joint replacement is sort of the last step. But generally speaking, it's only done in situations where you're having discomfort that you can't live with. There really isn't any other really good reason to replace a joint.
If I could ask a quick follow-up, is it an accurate model of this knee cartilage situation as though that knee cartilage was the rubber on a set of tires, and that if one can digest being less active and at this point simply wants to prolong relatively comfortable movement and lighter activities, should you view it that you don't want to take big road trips, that there's only so many, quote, miles left on your knees? or does the cartilage with healthy activity rejuvenate?
That varies a lot between individuals. Many folks, if they change their activities, can indeed remain comfortable and active. They're just not going to be able to run, 70 miles a week all the time. Other individuals, even when they change their activities, may still find that just with age, there is some degeneration of the cartilage, and it may indeed progress to the point where it's just uncomfortable to do much of anything. But there really isn't a good crystal ball to predict for a given individual what's going to happen.
So then is this glucosamine stuff pretty much the only known possible means of rebuilding cartilage at this time?
To the best of my knowledge, that's all that's currently available. There are some research trials where they're taking in the lab cells and trying to regrow cartilage with the hope that at some point you'd be able to implant that back into somebody. So there are studies going on along those lines, but in terms of other medications that you can take to help with your joints, as far as I know, the glucosamine is the only thing that's currently being recommended. Almost all of the other medications that you hear people taking for their joints are simply a pain reliever of one sort or another.
I see. Thank you very much.
All right, thanks for the call. We'll go now to somebody else here. This is Urbana, line 2. Hello.
Hello?
Yes.
Oh, thank you for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I have another joint and in the hands kind of question. I'm pushing 60 pretty hard, and I have older siblings, all of which have had some problem with this carpal tunnel stuff and a little bit of arthritis in the hands. And I'm noticing my fingers get numb when I do some, clutching the steering wheel too long or in one position too long. So I'm curious as to, is there a guideline as to when you would think of having some surgery or some various treatments for the carpal tunnel kind of condition?
Mm-hmm. Yes, there are. And again, it's pretty much symptom-driven. Carpal tunnel symptoms are relatively common for many people. They're transient, and they are indeed related to activity. What we're talking about are the bones at the wrist. These are referred to as your carpal bones. They form essentially a three-sided container for the nerves running down your arm to go into your hand. And then there's a bunch of tendons then on the fourth side to sort of complete the box. With physical movement of the wrist, you can sometimes get some irritation and inflammation in those tendons. And when they swell, they push against the nerve, because the other side of the nerve is where the bone is, and the bone isn't going to give. Most of the pressure gets directed onto the nerve. The median nerve runs right down the center of your wrist and predominantly supplies the thumb and first two fingers. And when pressure is put on that nerve, people complain oftentimes of numbness, tingling, or painful sensations, primarily in those first three digits. This is sometimes enough of a problem that it wakes people up at night. And in many instances, the initial treatment for this is to simply splint the wrist at night so that the wrist can't be bent. Because in many instances, it's the bending of the wrist that tends to aggravate this. So people who use their hands a lot for work, carpenters with a hammer or a screwdriver, in many instances, people who do a lot of typing or computer work with their wrist bent, can basically cause some irritation and swelling and some pressure on that nerve. That, in many instances, can be relieved by simply splinting the wrist at night. Now, if somebody has done that, change their activities. We often suggest a little anti-inflammatory agent to reduce swelling. People have tried vitamin supplementation and cortisone injections. But basically, if you've tried all of those things and you're still having significant, you know, pain or weakness, then surgery over the wrist to basically open up that space and give the nerve a little bit more room is the final treatment. But I would really have to say that probably 80% of the folks who have carpal tunnel don't come to surgery.
Do those tingling sensations and numbness, does that progress up the arm? Does it get farther out of the fingers and up to the elbow or something?
Because the nerve itself runs from your fingertips all the way back up to your spine and your neck, you can actually feel those symptoms anywhere along the path of the nerve. And yes, some people do have pain that radiates up towards their elbow, and I've had a few folks where they've had pain all the way up the shoulder and neck.
Oh, well, I haven't had pains. Mine's just I get numb or, you know, lose the sensation of a finger or two.
Mm-hmm.
And then when I shake my hand or change position, then it gradually goes away. So.
Right. And that would put you sort of at the milder end of the spectrum. And unless you find that to be, you know, unacceptable, probably not something that surgery would be recommended for.
Right. Yeah, I think that the thing that bothered me the most was one time I went out to shovel snow, and after I vigorously moved a lot of snow, and mm-hmm. then I came in and my wrists were really sore, and for a day or so I was, it was just hurting.
Right.
And then it finally went away. So.
Well, you mentioned a family history of some arthritis problems, and we know that people who especially have rheumatoid arthritis can get some bony abnormalities in their wrist, and that puts them at higher risk of carpal tunnel syndrome, simply because it encroaches on the space that the nerve has running through there. The other medical illness that is sometimes seen with carpal tunnel is an underactive thyroid, and occasionally we'll pick up somebody with that problem who came in with carpal tunnel complaints.
Well, thank you for your explanation. I appreciate it.
All right. Thank you. Let's go to Kansas, Illinois, line number 4, toll-free line. Hello.
Yeah, I'm a trucker, and I got diabetes. And, well, my doctor put me on some kind of a new medicine. I was on Actos, and my glucose wasn't getting down quite far enough. And he put me on this I don't know exactly how to say it. Januvia, something like that. And I was wondering if you could tell me something about that medicine. I was wondering if that's a safe medicine. Is that going to work on me all right? Because I don't want to go. I can't take insulin.
Because of your truck driving?
Yes.
All right. There are actually a large number of different oral medications that can be prescribed for diabetes, and I'm sorry, but I'm not recognizing the name of what you just said there.
Oh, okay. Well, I just thought maybe you might know something about it.
There are some relatively very, very new medications out for diabetes, but as I said, I don't recognize that name.
Okay. Well, thank you anyway.
I'm sorry.
Well, sorry we can't help. So, of course, though, if you want to give us a call, the number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have that toll-free line. That's 800-222-9455. We have about 5 minutes left. I want to ask you your opinion of something. Just recently in the news, I'm sure that people have heard that the city of New York passed this ordinance banning trans fats in the food served in their restaurants there. And so that means that, you know, in the French fries and the fried chicken and all of the kinds of things, I guess basically the issue is in stuff that's fried. They're going to have to use some other product that doesn't have trans fat. And the concern is that if you have a lot of trans fats in your diet, this increases your risk of heart disease. So
correct.
The recommendation is try to get that out of there. And I think that a lot of people will know. You go to the store now and you look at various products, they will clearly say on them, no trans fats,
right,
because they're trying to, you know, get you to think, oh, well, that's good. That's better for me. Maybe I'm kind of old fashioned, but I guess I kind of like the idea of getting at that issue through education. I don't know. And some when I say that, some people say to me, well, that's really naive because it doesn't matter. The doctor's laughing. Of course
well,
he knows.
Well, I'm going to ask you if you have the same, you know, feeling about, you know, driving under the influence of alcohol or not wearing a seatbelt. You know, there are a number of things that have just sort of been sort of recognized by society as just not a good thing to do. And they pass a rule or a law or a regulation, and they basically say, you know, you really shouldn't do that. education is still, yes, a very good thing. But in this particular setting, your point is well taken. They're going an extra step into, how far should society encroach on my personal liberty? But in this particular case, there are certainly healthier alternatives that are readily available. So, why not encourage that?
Well, if we did that, say we could say, all right, we're going to get rid of all the trans fats in the American diet. We're going to say that we can do that so that we don't have to worry about people doing what they know is good for them. We're going to make sure that at least in that respect, would that make a big difference, do you think, if we cut out all the trans fats?
It is a piece. Whether it's a huge piece, I think, remains to be seen. It's like the folks who say, gee, I eat a healthy diet. I have fruits and I have vegetables and I don't fry. And then you figure out, well, but you're consuming 5,000 calories a day. okay, that's 5,000 calories of healthy food, but it's still 5,000 calories, and those extra calories go somewhere. They become sugar and fat and cholesterol and triglycerides inside your body. Mm. And then you turn it into bad stuff. So you still have to practice some reasonable discretion in terms of diet, even if you get rid of the trans fats. I mean, you could still gorge yourself on lots of other things that would keep your cholesterol and your sugar up as well. And you haven't even hit the issue of, where does exercise fit in with your diet and your lifestyle? And then you throw in, cigarettes and a few other things. And, is getting rid of trans fats going to make heart disease go away in the United States? No.
Okay. Well, let's try to get at least one or two more calls here. Champagne, line one is next.
Yes,
hello.
Hi.
Yes.
I have a question going back to the carpal tunnel. Lady's question. I have carpal tunnel, at least that's what the doctor thinks. I've got, all the symptoms, the numbness in the hand and things like that. But anyway, over the last year, I've noticed that I have a tremor in my right hand where the carpal tunnel is. And it's only once in a while, like holding a fork when you're eating or something like that. And I don't have it any other places. So my question is, can that be related to the carpal tunnel from weakness and stress on the tendons and the muscles, or is this something I should be concerned about otherwise?
Tremor is typically not a symptom of carpal tunnel. But you are correct. With prolonged carpal tunnel, you can indeed get some muscular weakness, which then if you stress it by trying to grip or lift something that's, now too heavy, you could indeed get some tremor just from the muscular activity of trying to hold or lift something that's now too heavy. But tremor by itself is typically not a symptom associated with carpal tunnel.
Okay, so maybe that's something I need to investigate with the doctor further.
Right, and there are some very specific tests. If you're getting into this a little further, what's called an EMG, or nerve conduction velocity study, is an electrical test to measure how well that nerve runs down the arm into the hand, and in many instances that can confirm either carpal tunnel or lead to, testing for other neurologic conditions.
Okay. It's called an EMG?
Mm-hmm. That's correct.
Okay. And that would be something I would want to just then talk to the doctor about, maybe getting a test like that.
Correct.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. We'll see if we can do one more. Minunk here, line number four. Hello.
Hello.
Yeah.
Yeah. Hello. My wife is 73. Her doctor thinks perhaps she should go on Beneva, even though her bone density is quite high. Do you think it's a good idea? And could there be bad side effects? I read that there can be with Fosamax, and if so, what would they be?
The side effects related to those types of medications are all similar. The medications that you mentioned are Boniva, Fosamax, and the other common one is Actonel. And they can all potentially cause quite a bit of irritation to the esophagus if the medication is not taken correctly.
Wasn't there something about the teeth also or gums or something that it can affect?
One of the medications, and I believe it's Fosamax, has been questioned as to whether some deterioration in the dental structure of the jaw could potentially be an associated side effect. That's still being kind of debated and looked at. There really isn't any reason to be on a medication like this if, in fact, her bone density test is normal, and this assumes that they did a good test. There are some individuals who have very thick calcium deposits as a result of arthritis, and the test can be abnormal because of that, and it's basically a falsely normal test. You can have very, very thin bone, but have your bone mineral density test score look good if the test was taken right through a calcified area where there was a lot of arthritic change. So this is a sort of a finer point that you'd probably need to discuss with your doctor, because otherwise, if truly her bone mineral density test is normal, there probably isn't any reason to need the medication.
I understand. Okay. One more quick question. Glucosamine, is that sufficient in itself, or do you need the chondroitin with it?
Most of the studies have basically shown that it's the glucosamine that seems to be the most useful.
Yeah.
So the chondroitin is often packaged with it, but I don't think it adds that much.
No. It seems the doctors I've heard of, they seem to recommend both, and I wondered, I noticed they sell it either way.
Right. And I typically tell my folks it's just the glucosamine, and if they want to buy that by themselves, that's fine.
Okay, well, thank you.
All right, thank you. Well, there we will wrap it up for this time around. Our guest, Dr. Jeff Swearingen, the family practice physician at Carl Clinic in Urbana. He's here every other month, always on Monday, so we'll see him again in February. Right? No? Oh. Yes? Maybe? I don't know.
Whenever you tell me,
okay.
I'll be here, Dave.
All right, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Here. We appreciate it.